Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, we go to City Hall Plaza for Hub Week, Boston's festival for the future. Also today, two minority students at Harvard weigh in on the lawsuit alleging that their university discriminates against Asian Americans in its admissions policy.
Don't use us as an excuse. Find another reason that you're not doing this in our name.
On top of getting good grades, on top of getting great internships, you have this additional burden of having to justify your existence at this elite institution that other people simply just don't have.
And a professor goes to extremes to find out what philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche can teach us today.
Basically, what I did when I was in the Alps was I walked 15, 20 miles in a day, and I fasted. I just wanted to see if Nietzsche was right, that whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
That's all coming up next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz. And we start today by jumping over to City Hall Plaza, where Hub Week is well underway. You know Hub Week, Boston's annual festival for the future. And joining me now from Hub Week is Radio Boston's own Jamie Bologna. Hey, Jamie.
Hey, Evan, how you doing?
I'm doing really well. Festival for the future is quite a tagline. It sounds really grand and idealistic, and I'm eager to hear what's actually happening there. What are you seeing?
Well, it is grand and idealistic. We're actually in the thick of Hub Week right now. It's in its fourth day, and I'm at the WBUR booth. It's outside the center stage. It's in this massive tent protecting us from the rain.
Important. You don't want to get all wet.
I know. I don't want to get electrocuted with all this equipment. There are people coming and going. There are speeches happening as we speak. I was walking around Hub Week a little earlier, and there's kind of something for everyone here. There's a lot of public art. There are these two massive round domes for an immersive multimedia experience. There's a presentation hall. They're calling it the Hall of the Future, with VR headsets and 3D printers and robotic arms.
Did you get a VR headset?
Furnished living room. I didn't get my own. They're not handing them out. They're letting you use them. There's also these wax figures of Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, which are a little creepy. But in terms of what actually happens here, it's a chance to hear these big, deep, smart conversations and talks with people who are facing and thinking about the ideas that we'll be facing in the future.
And, like, what kinds of things are they talking about? What were they talking about today?
So they're covering a lot of ground in any given day. But just for today, there was a session on legalized marijuana and parenting. There were a couple of film screenings. There's a session on laughter yoga, because laughter is apparently the best medicine. There's conversations on filmmaking and data analytics and the importance of diversity in the workforce. But I would say the heart of today's events are these big fora on the main stage, and they're focusing on the future of work, data, and robotics.
In some ways, that's sort of too bad. I'd like to talk about laughter yoga more, but since we're doing work, data, and robotics, I'll just ask the big robot question, which is, how long before they steal all our jobs?
Well, I have to say, we're not that original to come up with that question. It's been said a lot on the main stage today. And a lot of folks sort of said, you know what, look, they are coming for our jobs, but maybe in a different way than we might think. So earlier I was speaking to some of the folks at the Cambridge-based company Soft Robotics. They make these like robot arms with cushy finger things that pick up delicate items like fish or eggs or fruit. And they told me that in their view, they're not taking people's jobs. Instead, they're helping companies complete sort of repetitive, sometimes difficult and dangerous tasks, sort of filling jobs that companies are struggling to fill anyway with our low unemployment rate. That's their view anyway.
And if it's true, it's not bad to take jobs that people don't want to be doing and replace those jobs with robots.
And in a more positive, sort of collaborative way, I spoke earlier with Ty Brady. He's the chief technologist at Amazon Robotics. He's a deeply Boston guy. He was a draper. He founded Mass Robotics. He knows robots. And he told me that we're just in the infancy of the field, the sort of first inning, first batter up, if you will. And I asked him about the jobs question, and here's what he said.
I call it a symphony of humans and machines working together. Humans are really good at problem solving and generalization and abstraction. We're amazing at that. Millions of years we've been working on that. We never, ever want to give that up. And machines are good at moving with precision and moving objects and large databases and remembering where everything is. When you think of an effective system design, you bring those together, and that's really an edge, right, where you do not make it a versus situation, but you make it a collaborative situation.
So, in other words, from his perspective, Amazon is always going to be a company that will have a need for people, and he noted that as they increase their numbers of robots, they also increase the number of human workers at any given location.
Was there anyone saying actually, this is just a terrible crisis?
No one has said that yet, but
right.
You can be that guy. But maybe a little later in the show, we're actually going to talk to someone who's working on something related to robots, and that's artificial intelligence. But first, Evan, if I could, I would like to introduce someone who's here with me. It's one of the co-founders of Hub Week. She's also the managing director of the Boston Globe, Linda Pizzuti-Henry. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us here. In terms of what Evan and I were just talking about and what Hub Week is and what it means and what you're trying to do, what are you trying to accomplish this year? Our fourth year.
So this year's theme is We the Future, and it's this idea that we collectively can help build the future, and we all have a voice in what that future looks like. And so, like in previous years, it is an immersive experience with, like you said, a little, there's something for everybody, but the main point is that it is welcoming and inclusive, but we do really deep dives into areas that are defining the future, such as robotics, such as life sciences, such as hard tech, and what it all means.
And politics.
I heard
you earlier interviewing Ayanna Pressley from the main stage. And so I guess I'm just curious from that conversation where you see the future of politics going.
That's a simple question.
If you could do it in like 10 seconds, that'd be great.
The future of politics is something that I think everybody at every news organization is studying closely, and it's happening, and we'll see. I think everybody's waiting to see what happens this November in that front. But, you know, a lot of the conversations, you know, the idea behind Hub Week is that the future is being built here in Boston at the intersection of art, science, and technology. Yesterday, I hosted a conversation with Anne McKee, who is a neuropathologist who has done the breakthrough research on CTE. And what's so interesting about her is that her training when she was young was as a visual artist. And that training as a visual artist has really enabled her to be incredibly successful, and particularly one of the best neuropathologists is her ability to recognize patterns. And so, and you know, when I was in my conversation with Ayanna, she was a performer, she was a singer. And that singing, how that's prepared her. And so just really incredible intersections, which you'll see in the robotics conversations as well, of the importance of the art, of the design, of the interface. You're talking about how, you know, how people interact with AI and the sort of how it's all coming together. It's and so much of it is happening right here in Boston.
And so I do want to ask you, since some of this is the future of work, and you're the managing director of the Globe.
Sure.
You know, I don't need to tell you that the Globe has had layoffs and buyouts throughout the years. The Herald has 140 fewer people since its sale. And so I'm just wondering if you're optimistic about the future of work for journalists and journalism.
I think that there is an incredibly important role that journalism plays in every community. And that is hard to replace. You cannot automate that at this point.
Yeah.
There are
at this point,
but there, you know, there is commodity news that you can automate. You can automate reports on financial earnings, and they've shown that they can do that. But there is other stuff that you cannot. You know, there's a conversation about AI and that Colin Engel was leading today in the Ideas Dome here at Hub Week, and he was saying, look, you can have AI look at something and recognize that that is a chair. And you're like, wow, that's amazing. But that's all it can do. You know, you can't say now, you know,
analyze that chair.
How does my mother feel about this?
Right. Yeah.
or you know, sort of other things. There's amazing things that AI can do, but there are also incredible limits. And there are certain professions, there's certain work jobs, and journalism is one of them. Where again, the commodity stuff can be automated, but the deep investigative reporting cannot.
And so is that something that you see continuing to grow and thrive here in Boston as someone leading a media institution?
Do I see journalism continuing? I think that the need for journalism will always be present in every community. And Boston is a community that is particularly engaged. And so we've been very lucky to have the support of so many people in our community who subscribe because they believe in the importance of journalism.
And so we mentioned this is the fourth year
yes,
of Hub Week. What have you learned in these 4 years, and what are you hoping to accomplish in, you know, the 5 year
yes.
big year next year?
So this has been just such an incredible experience for me and everybody on the team, because it's given me a chance to go and meet so many different artists and individuals and businesses and communities throughout Boston. And there's this similar refrain of, you know, Massachusetts is the home for robotics.
Mm-hmm.
We need to tell that story. Massachusetts is a home for life sciences. We need to tell that story. Massachusetts is a home for higher education. Massachusetts is a home for all these things. And collectively, we as a region need to tell our story. And that's much better told as a chorus. And Hub Week is a not-for-profit collaboration. It is something that, you know, it started with Harvard, MIT, Mass General Hospital, mm-hmm. and the Boston Globe. All four of these institutions really generously put their resources and time and energy into building this. And then we said, join us. And we have over 200 companies and organizations that are part of this. And that's something that's really important, that collectively we can tell the story and in an inclusive way of what is happening here in the city and what the future is going to look like.
Well, it's exciting, and we'll continue following it. That's Linda Pizzuti-Henry. She's co-founder of Hub Week and managing director of the Boston Globe. Thank you so much for talking.
Thank you for being here. I hope you're able to take in some more events here.
Thank
while
you,
you're,
I will.
And I expect to see you at the Silent Disco tonight.
Oh, tonight with the wireless headphones.
Yes.
I'll see if I can make it. Evan, back to you in the studio.
Well, that's Radio Boston producer-reporter Jamie Bologna. Jamie, stay dry. We'll check in with you a little later in the hour. Tomorrow on the show, Radio Boston's Chris Siderek will join us live from Hub Week, where he'll speak with some top folks at Google and iRobot. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz, and maybe you can hear it. Tick, tick, tick. The sound of time potentially running out on America's experiment with affirmative action. Students for Fair Admissions, they're an anti-affirmative action group, they're suing Harvard, charging that the admissions process discriminates against Asian American applicants. Harvard insists they have the legal right to assemble a diverse class, and that race is just one of a number of factors they consider when making admissions decisions. Already this week, we've talked to legal experts on both sides of this issue. Today, we have perspective from two students. First up, Julie Chung, co-chair of the Pan-Asian Council. Over the summer, she wrote a much-discussed op-ed for the Harvard Crimson titled, "Students for Fair Admission and Harvard Both Got It Wrong." So let's start there. How did the SFFA, remember that's the Anti-Affirmative Action Group, how'd they get it wrong?
The initial claim, right, that SFFA, Students for Fair Admissions, got it wrong, is coming out of the idea that right now they're attacking affirmative action programs and race-conscious admissions using Asian Americans as the sort of excuse or the key to this whole situation, that actually race-conscious admissions are a way for Harvard to discriminate and not necessarily support students of color. And
so you think in some ways they're sort of using Asian American students as part of a broader strategy to undermine affirmative action more generally?
I mean, I do think it's a little more complicated than that. Obviously, the Asian Americans involved in the case, too, have some say in this. But at the same time, Edward Blum, the conservative activist who's
behind the group.
Behind the group.
Yeah.
This isn't his first case. It's just so happens that now in this new iteration of his attack on affirmative action, he has found this group of Asian Americans to, in his argument, as portraying these people as students of color who are at the same time being somehow disadvantaged by race-conscious admissions.
You yourself, you support the ideals of affirmative action, the idea that diversity is an important virtue at a university?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think that's something that's highlighted in the piece I wrote.
So, I mean, what do you think diversity brings to a university that's so important?
I think diversity is, of course, important in terms of, everyone talks about the kind of educational benefits or the social benefits of having a diverse learning environment. And I do concede to a lot of those points, but I think more than this kind of diverse learning environment that seems a little wishy-washy to me that affirmative action brings, it's more about its potential, right, to actually help people of color who have been historically put at a disadvantage in arenas of higher education. So I think that affirmative action has the potential, maybe it's not perfect at this state, but still has the potential to remedy a lot of those inequalities.
Do you think of it as like an engine of opportunity for people who haven't had access before?
Definitely.
So then, what's Harvard getting wrong in this?
So I think this piece was written at a point in the summer when there were these allegations of Harvard potentially having a bias. I don't think there's sufficient data to say whether Harvard is actually discriminating or not. But the fact that Asian Americans were so concerned because of the certain types of stereotypes that they've grown up with and maybe even come to internalize and fear, especially things like the model minority stereotype, the idea that Asian Americans, just by virtue of their race and culture, are more hardworking, and that feeds into a lot of stereotypes about the kind of Asian American test taker and the kind of molded and perhaps uncreative Asian American student. The fact that Harvard perhaps is getting it wrong, that sentiment is not coming from necessarily that they're discriminating against, they're possibly using race admissions to discriminate against Asian Americans in the admissions process, but that Asian Americans, even though they'll support Harvard and their endeavors to keep race-conscious admissions, that doesn't mean that we're not going to still keep Harvard accountable to its students of color and to its Asian American students in continuing to support them.
Now, you mentioned also that part of the reason you feel strongly about affirmative action is as an engine of opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder how economics plays into this for you. I mean, I know, for instance, and I think you talk about it in the piece, that one of the things about the Asian American community in the United States is that on average, they've been very successful, but it's also the most unequal racial community in the country. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if there's discussion about this, about whether these kinds of programs help the poorer, more struggling parts of the Asian American community in the U.S. or how that plays in.
Yeah, I think you're right in pointing out how easy it is to gloss over the fact that affirmative action can bring great benefits to the Asian American community, particularly those on the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum, which are frequently glossed over, right? So the Pacific Islander community, so people like Vietnamese immigrants, Hmong immigrants, Cambodian immigrants, the fact that these communities have such low access to education and have such low levels of college entrance and graduation rates. And the fact that affirmative action and race-conscious admissions policies can greatly benefit those communities if used in that way.
If this lawsuit goes forward and admissions becomes race blind, how would that affect the way people enter, the kind of identity that you brought to Harvard, the kind of identity that other people bring to Harvard? Would it be diminished? Do you worry about this?
I do worry about this a lot because I think it's important to highlight that this case isn't just affecting you know, the kinds of learning environments or the diversity just within the college itself. What does it do to the high school student who's applying to college and needs to represent themselves on this application? I think that race-blind admissions is maybe implicitly, but maybe even explicitly, saying that race is not important, right? That race is not an important part of your identity because it has not affected your material circumstances, but perhaps like living in a quote-unquote post-racial society, as these people claim, that it also does not affect your identity at all. And your identity, right, is such an important part of your application process to college. And for me, when I was applying to Harvard and to college more broadly, race was such a large factor of my application. Race informed a lot of the activities that I did on campus. So I started a group for Asian American students at my high school, and it informed what kinds of groups I was searching for and what communities I wanted to contribute to and be a part of once I joined college. And I made that very clear on my application. And race informed a lot of the research interests that I had in high school. Race informed the supplement essay that I sent and the kind of identity that I formed in high school that would then inform what kind of student I would be and what kinds of experiences I would add to my college community. And I think that if I came in to this application process with the idea that those factors, all of them didn't matter, I don't know what I would have been left with, how I would have represented myself to the fullest.
The trial starts Monday. Mm-hmm. If you got 2 minutes in chambers with the judge, you know, is there something you particularly want to say?
I think I would say that if the ultimate goal is to, you know, whether it be, you know, supporting students of color, addressing historical inequalities by racism, making education access more equitable, I think that SFFA is trying to say that if you have these ideals, then you would take away race-conscious admissions because it is, in fact, hurting Asian Americans. And I would tell the judge that actually there are many Asian Americans who do not believe that at all, and that if you're going to get rid of affirmative action, don't say you're doing it for the Asian American community, because that's a statement that many of us reject. So don't use us as an excuse. Find another reason that you're not doing this in our name.
That's Harvard student Julie Chung, co-chair of the Pan-Asian Council and previous co-president of the Harvard Radcliffe Asian American Women's Association. Julie, thanks so much for being with us.
No, thank you.
Earlier today, we spoke with Amber Ashley James, a law and business student at Harvard and a member of the Black Law Student Association. James sides with Harvard. More than that, she sees the lawsuit as an attempt to further the goals of Edward Blum, who's helped orchestrate this and other cases against affirmative action. She talked about how this case has divided the Harvard community.
America is real polarized and real divisive as it is right now. 18 to 21-year-old kids don't need this right now on their campus. Kids are trying to live their lives. They're trying to go to class. This is the last thing that they need, bringing that polarization and that division home to where these students are living and working. Even the Asian American community is very divided on this issue. I'm Black American, I'm not Asian American, but I know from the face of the counter protest to this lawsuit on Harvard's campus right now is Asian American women. They have taken this charge and run with it, planning panels, planning marches. And then on the other side, of course, there are Asian Americans on campus and elsewhere who are in support of this, who, you know, feel as though they've been discriminated and this is their chance to vindicate, you know, the way that they've been wronged by this unfair system. So I think it's divisive on campus in general amongst, you know, the sort of umbrella of people of color. I think it's specifically divisive and counterproductively divisive within the Asian American community as well, in a way that just does not serve the interests of Asian American students at all.
And just to give voice to those who do support the lawsuit, there is an ethical principle behind it, like a principle of fairness, right? The claim is something like, the way the system is designed discriminates against Asian American applicants who have the highest academic credentials but the lowest admission rates. Right? Because this came out in part of the lawsuit, they seem to get lower scores on non-academic parts of the Harvard admissions process for their sort of softer side, the personality ratings and things like that. And the sort of the ethical argument behind it is like, that's just not fair. You should be evaluating people according to the same measure, regardless of their ethnic background. Where's that breakdown?
Sure, I disagree. And I think if you really want to talk about fairness in the admissions process, the biggest boost that you can get in the admissions process, if you're looking at similarly situated applicants with similar backgrounds, the biggest boost that you can get is being a legacy. The biggest aspect of the Harvard application system that is unfair is completely absent from this lawsuit. To be ignoring the single most unfair factor in Harvard's admissions process kind of says to me that they're not actually interested in fairness. They're interested in getting rid of race-conscious admissions, but they're not interested in making sure that the application process is fair. I say that as a legacy. My dad graduated from Harvard College. My parents met at Harvard Law School. There are very few Black American legacies. Legacy status is something that helps wealthy white students. And Bloom's not interested in any sort of remedy that decreases the number of white students at Harvard. I don't want to completely dismiss Asian American applicants who feel as though they have been wronged. If you feel like you've been wronged in this process, this is not the remedy that you should be seeking. Greater oversight over the admissions process, or having a more diverse admissions committee that is perceptive to and empathetic to and reflective of the body of students that are applying to be admitted to Harvard. None of those remedies are being sought.
The argument is something like, something is going wrong with this process, therefore you need a totally new process. Instead of, something's going on with this process, therefore we need to fix the process.
Right, like if you're
even
alleging,
whether you acknowledge or not, but if you acknowledge that something may be going on
in
the process.
If you allege, as they're doing in this case, that something is wrong in this process, then let's look at the process. Let's figure out what's going on in the process and figure out what remedies would actually address that alleged problem.
So I raised the fairness issue before, and you were pretty insistent you want me to put words in your mouth. So I'm going to give you more words that you really are going to insist you do not want to have put
All
in
right.
your mouth right now. So we spoke to a number of people this week, including Ilya Shapiro of the Cato Institute, a think tank in Washington, D.C. He supports students for fair admissions, and he questioned the use of affirmative action policies for a few big reasons, including this one.
It's unfair that even members of racial minorities benefit all that much from preferences that put some people into universities that are maybe above where they would otherwise be. And so they begin to achieve at lower levels, and they see that other people who are achieving at lower levels are also members of racial minority groups.
It's an argument sometimes called mismatch. When you use racial preferences in the admissions process, you end up admitting people who are not ready for university, and they are therefore trapped in a position where they can't succeed, which is not good for anyone. You're looking at me with eyes that I wish I could convey over the radio.
Shooting my worst side eye at you, because that was actually wild. So it's personally offensive because that mentality that students of color are unfit to be at Harvard, that mentality is actually incredibly common. It is usually a more subtle ethos of being a little bit dismissive towards the students of color in class, not really taking them seriously, not really taking their contribution seriously, not thinking of them as peers, people that you are on the same level with that you can learn from, but people that, you know, snuck in the back door and aren't really worth your time. And that is absolutely a mentality that I have experienced at Harvard and in other elite spaces. And it's personally offensive because I feel like it puts students of color, Black and Latino students Latinx students specifically in the position of constantly trying to prove that we belong there. And that's just, and on top of playing a sport, on top of going to class, on top of getting good grades, on top of getting great internships, you have this additional burden of trying to justify, of having to justify your existence at this elite institution that other people simply just don't have. Like, it's ridiculous. It is disrespectful, it's dismissive, and it's a burden that Black and Latinx students simply shouldn't have
to
carry.
Let's stick with this question about the application itself and the resume, because we also spoke to Julie Chung. She's an undergraduate at Harvard currently, and she expressed a concern about race-blind admissions, which is that it would strip her of the ability to tell her story. Being Asian American for her is a big part of her identity. How could she convey who she is in the application process without that information? Does this strike you as a real concern?
I absolutely relate to that. I mean, I can't talk about myself in a way that doesn't reveal that I'm a Black woman. And that's the remedy that's being sought in this lawsuit, is to strip away a student's ability to present themselves as a whole, complex human being, in which race is a fundamental part of that, especially in America, especially in 2018, and say, you need to present the sanitized version of yourself that talks about your academics, talks about your sports, talks about your extracurriculars, but not in a way that gives any indication of your racial or ethnic background, because Harvard's not allowed to consider that. If you're trying to understand who a 17, 18-year-old high school kid is, why take away their ability to present themselves as a whole human being in this process that is supposed to be about evaluating people as whole, complex human beings? I there's no way that I could submit an application and not talk about being a Black woman, because the fact that I'm a Black woman who grew up in Florida, in the South, is a huge part of my identity. It's a huge part of the experiences that I've had. And it's a part of the person that I'm going to be once I get there.
That's Amber Ashley James. She's currently a law and business student at Harvard who lives and works with current undergraduate students. She's also a member of the Black Law Student Association and attended Harvard for undergrad, graduating in 2011. Thanks again for joining us, Amber.
Thanks so much for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz. Let's check back in with Radio Boston's Jamie Bologna down at Hub Week, City Hall Plaza. Hey, Jamie, who do you have at the booth now?
Hey, Evan. I'm joined now by Jillian Armstrong. She works on AI and cognitive technologies at Liberty Mutual. Hello, Jillian.
Hi there.
So can we start with sort of what that actually means and what you do?
Sure. So mostly what I work on is chatbots, so technology that can just have a conversation with you, and we're putting those on our websites and in our call centers at Liberty Mutual.
So, okay, when I hear chatbots and call centers, I think people that used to do that are now not doing that. So how are you thinking about the jobs that may be lost in this transition?
Yeah. So what we're trying to do is we're just trying to take away the simple questions, the questions that, as a call center rep, you don't want to answer the same question over and over and over again, and divert those over to the chatbots. And free up the call center reps to do things that humans are good at, sort of the empathy and creativity, and they've got time to spend more time with their customers. So we're not looking to replace people, we're looking to augment them.
But I saw a piece that you wrote about teaching chatbots empathy. So if you don't want the chatbots to take the job of the people, then why try to teach them empathy?
So I do think that we are quite a long way out from, from chatbots really being able to empathize with you. I think what we do want the chatbots to do is to empathize with you insofar as they can realize you're frustrated and that they would be better to pass it off to a human.
I see. But still, I what do you say to the regular people who are listening out there and are legitimately worried of, like, no, like, I work in a call center somewhere and I don't want this. Like, what do you say to that?
Yeah. So I guess as a person that calls a call center, you don't want to wait for 45 minutes to get a really simple answer.
No, so but I also don't love the idea of yelling at I'm sorry, I didn't understand that on the other end, you know?
And I think for the people who work in call centers, the technology is still very emerging. it's definitely not going to be taking anyone's job today.
Uh-huh.
Maybe in 5 or 10 years we will see it. So maybe if you do work in a call center, you need to start thinking about, okay, so what are the things that... We're still going to need people. People need people.
Mm-hmm.
We're an insurance company. We're there to support people. We don't want to just put you onto a computer and never have you interact with any people. That would be a terrible experience. That's not what we want.
Right. So, okay, you're someone who's looked at and studied AI for a while now. Where do you see the sort of next frontier of AI?
So I think definitely... watching how it's integrating into our lives through things like smart speakers, virtual assistants. Definitely very much people are really accepting it into their day-to-day lives. And I think that is the next. Voice technologies are going to be a massive thing. We're going to just expect them to be able to handle little tasks. People are using them to set timers and do their shopping lists. But it's just going to get sort of more and more pervasive. We're just going to be used to them being there.
Okay, but so along those lines then, Elon Musk, among many others, have warned of the dangers of AI and that maybe they need more regulation. I mean, not to be a Nelly negative here on this field, but is that a concern? Is that something you're thinking about?
I think it's obviously something you need to think about, of course. And there are privacy issues, and of course we don't want AI to just rule our lives and make decisions for us. But I do think there is a really powerful thing in sort of helping us have better lives and be more human. So if you think about voice assistants, they've really helped us sort of take our eyes off screens
mm-hmm.
and start looking at other humans and start actually having conversations with other humans as well in the room. So I do think there is a bright future, and I think we're a very long way out, any sort of sentient AI. So we don't need to worry about it today.
All right. So then we'll stay hopeful for the future. Jillian Armstrong is a technologist at Liberty Mutual. Thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you very much.
Evan, back to you at WBUR.
Radio Boston producer, reporter, Jamie Bologna, live at Hub Week in City Hall Plaza. Thanks so much, Jamie.
Thank you, Evan.
It all began with an envelope stuffed with cash. Except this one didn't end up at the center of a heist film. It landed in the palm of a 19-year-old student, eager to better understand Friedrich Nietzsche by visiting the Swiss mountains where the German philosopher wrote some of his most important works. Some 20 years later, that student, now a philosophy professor at UMass Lowell and a family man, went back. And his latest book tells the entangled story of those two visits. It's called Hiking with Nietzsche, On Becoming Who You Are. Part memoir, part philosophical exploration, part confession. The author, John Keg, joins me now in the studio. John, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having
me. It's amazing to have you in the studio, having read the book and like worked with whatever aspect of yourself got poured into the pages. I'm excited to sit across from you and ask you questions now. Are you excited to answer questions? Well, look, we'll get to Nietzsche in a second, but I really do want to start by asking, like, it seems like it's a book about you. Even more than it's a book about Nietzsche, your path to becoming a philosopher father and a family. Am I overreading that? Is that
no,
how it felt?
No, it's a book about life and a book about philosophy, and those two things should not be divorced. So the idea that philosophy can be a type of therapy for a person.
And including the philosophy of Nietzsche. I mean, it's true lots of people think about using philosophy for therapy or as therapy, but Nietzsche's not always the first one who comes to mind, but let's pause for a second, right? So we got to get some grounding here. Nietzsche, he's right in the title. The book is full of his ideas, aphorisms, a lot of biographical detail. Give us one grounding principle to help us understand what Nietzsche was all about.
Sure. So many 19-year-olds, I'm not alone in being drawn to Nietzsche. So his concept of the will to power, the idea that what human beings find most meaningful in life are volition and acts of volition, meaningful, creative acts.
Acts
of choice, yeah. Exercising your will in meaningful ways. Many young men who are brought up in conventional backgrounds, like I was at 19, Central Pennsylvania, brought up in a Lutheran family, not unlike Nietzsche's. I was a good little church boy, a good little schoolboy, just like Nietzsche. And for men and women in their teens who are brought up that way, Nietzsche is the invitation to be otherwise. It's an invitation to escape. And that's what I saw when I was given that envelope.
And you got this envelope. But who gave you this envelope? First of all, because it's amazing. Like, how many students get an envelope full of cash from...
That's right. Yeah. So at the end of my junior year, my professor, Douglas Anderson, and my professor teaching me Nietzsche, Dan Conway, got together and handed me an envelope for $3,000 and said, you're writing a thesis on the will to power and insanity and genius. And
this is an undergrad thesis.
It was a master's thesis.
And
you should go to Sils Maria. And we've already set this up. You're going to stay in Friedrich Nietzsche's house, which is now a museum, but they had contacted the curators. And for 9 weeks, I hiked the trails behind Sils Maria and tried to exercise my will to power to both good effect, but more often when I was 19, to pretty disastrous effect.
Yeah, you had some harrowing moments in that first trip.
I did. And in fact, part of the book is about the limitations of the will to power. Nietzsche is known by fascists, by the alt-right, as a philosopher of the hammer. It's all about exercising the will. And part of this book is about how misguided that interpretation of Nietzsche actually is.
The fact that you had these harrowing moments as a 19-year-old, it's hard to know reading the book. Did you want to? That is, were you going there to, I don't know, face your mortality in a way that you understood or knew at the time?
That's a great question. So... when Nietzsche says famously that God is dead, what he means is that the cultural institutions of our lives, that church, state, family, in the 1860s and still today, those don't exercise the same power over us as they once did historically. And the question for Nietzsche was, what are you to do in the absence of their guidance? And going to Switzerland for the first time, it was my first time outside of Pennsylvania. It was the first time that I had ever considered radical freedom, radical possibility. And Nietzsche, like his contemporary Soren Kierkegaard, thinks that radical freedom is accompanied by anxiety, great anxiety. And that's what I experienced up in the mountains the first time.
And you left with a scar.
I did. I got lost and lost in the mountains for 2 days. And it turned out it was very cold and I was unprepared. I had not packed.
I'm high in the Swiss mountains. It can be cold.
It turns out it can be very cold, even in summer. And frost nip actually scarred my left ear. Yeah.
So in some ways, the story could end there. And I think for a lot of people, it does. You're 19. You go on this sort of romantic journey. But it doesn't for you. You're in your late 30s, I should say. I kind of resent that in the book you talk about that, how that's middle age, you know, for those of us who are even further along. Anyway, you're in your mid to late
30s.
Cresting. Okay. And you say, you know what? I'm going back. And not only am I going back, I'm going to take my wife, I'm going to take my daughter, and we're going to go together on this journey that was really challenging to my 19-year-old self.
Right. So, I mean, Nietzsche is usually regarded as a philosopher of the teenager. As an adolescent philosopher, something you should grow out when you hit the responsible middle years of your life. But I actually think that the Übermensch, or Nietzsche's overman, this promise of some sort of existential freedom or ideal, is best suited to those people who have begun to crest their 40s. And it's actually a promise that you can still break free, or that you can deviate from the expectations of your culture. And so when I returned when I was 36, I was actually considering, well, how do you actually realize freedom while at the same time being deeply enmeshed in a family that you love dearly?
Well, that's one thing I wanted to ask coming out of the book. Were you searching when you went back, this kind of radical freedom, for yourself or for a kind of freedom for all three of you? I mean, do you imagine this trip as an opportunity for you and your wife and your daughter separately to experience freedom? I don't know. How did you think about that?
I mean, it's easy to be completely dissolved in relationships, in community. And I think many people experience their 40s and 50s as losing themselves in the midst of communities or in the midst of families or relationships. And I think what I was trying to do in this second trip is to figure out some sort of middle position between radical individualism and losing yourself in community. And I think if you think about Nietzsche's most famous work, Thus Spoke Zarathustra, Zarathustra is somebody who usually we think about as a hermit, as somebody who thinks that people...
Well, he's off in the mountains,
he's
thinking
off
through his philosophy until he comes to his insight.
That's right. People don't need other people. Yeah. And so I think that... If you read that book more carefully, however, you notice that he's always shuttling between the lowlands where he communes with others and the high peaks of solitude. And so part of the book is trying to negotiate that tension that I think many of us experience in our 40s and 50s between individualism and togetherness.
So just to get at this tension, there is a passage I really would like you to read. It's a beautiful passage that a couple of us actually stumbled upon independently and we all really loved. So there's this moment you've gone off on your own, right? And you've taken this sort of hazardous journey, a pilgrimage, call it a pilgrimage. And there's something sort of unsatisfying at the end of it, and you don't know what to do. And then, well, you go ahead and read.
Perhaps pilgrims triumph not in hardship, but in the rare moment when they learn to accept something soft at home. As I sat under my rock, my temporary home, an otherworldly chuckle, which I still don't understand, escaped me, and I arose. I made toward my family, walking away from the site of pilgrimage, toward what Becca, my 6-year-old daughter, fondly calls softing. One doesn't have to go anywhere to experience softing. Softing is usually performed with the back of a hand or, if you're Becca, her nose. It is the softest of strokes. Softing can't be done at a distance. It usually takes place in the early mornings or late at night, almost every day, preferably with all the members of her family in bed. One can soft spontaneously or ask to be softed, and the request is always granted. In the midst of softing, uncontrollable laughter is not only permitted, but expected. It is the opposite of hardship, and these are love's true conditions.
I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful passage, hardship and softship, softing, the soft verb. And I mean, it's a really touching moment in the book, you're coming back. I wonder how you think of it philosophically. Like, does this count as anti-Nietzschean? It feels very anti-Nietzschean.
That's a wonderful question. So usually when we think about Nietzsche, we think about the will to power, this very hard philosophy of the hammer. But there's another side to Nietzsche as well, a vulnerable, receptive side. And I would direct readers to his discussions of what is known as the amor fati, which is the love of fate. Nietzsche says that not only do we have to exercise our will, but we also, in this love of fate, have to embrace those moments which we find most embarrassing, most despicable, the hardest. And I think that that's actually a side of Nietzsche that needs to be emphasized, even sometimes more than just the will to power.
Hmm. So the other big subtext here is your search for a father, right? In Nietzsche, of all people. Your own father left when you were a kid, and that gave you a kind of kinship, as Nietzsche's father seems to have gone crazy and died. I hope it's not a stretch to say that you're building on this, a kind of similarity between the two of you, your search for father, Nietzsche's. That's part of the structure of how you think about your relationship?
It's not a stretch at all. And in fact, I'm drawn to philosophers who actually have lost their parents. So Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, Gabriel Marcel. And so I think that at least at first, I thought about philosophy as a way of compensating for something that I'd lost. But I think as I've become a father myself, my relationship to philosophy has changed. And I think that philosophy is a way for us to negotiate the hardest parts of middle age.
Hmm. Well, let's add this fun little tidbit. One of the people Nietzsche looked for as a surrogate father was Wagner. Yes, this Wagner. Admit it, you love it. Nietzsche did turn against Wagner. I mean, do you imagine a time when you could turn against Nietzsche? Lots
yes.
of people do.
And in fact, the last two chapters are where I leave Nietzsche behind. There's hardly any mention of Nietzsche, and that's intentional. Maybe Nietzsche can't give us everything that we need, and maybe that's for the best. Maybe Nietzsche's best use when we leave him behind.
Well, I want to end with a question about another quote in your book, with a quote from Nietzsche. I profit from a philosopher only insofar as he can be an example. So if Nietzsche's right about this, how can we profit from him? And I specifically, how can those of us in what you call middle age profit from Nietzsche?
That's a great question. So objectively, Nietzsche's life was one of deep tragedy. He never managed to have a lasting relationship. He had a vexed relationship with his family, and a sad end of life. what he does do for us in our 40s and 50s is asks us to own up to life. And I think that ownership, we own up not only to the glorious parts of life, but also to the hardship. And I think that that's something that Nietzsche teaches us.
That's John Keg. He's a professor of philosophy at UMass Lowell and the author of the new book, Hiking with Nietzsche. John, thanks so much for coming.
Thanks so much.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Zoe Mitchell, with help today from Eve Zuckoff. Tim Skog is our technical director. A special thanks to George Hicks and the WBUR engineering team for their help with Hub Week. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Evan Horowitz. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.